The struggle is real for women of color in leadership. From battling race and cultural biases to silencing that relentless inner critic, it's a lot. Welcome to Unshackled Leadership, a lantern for Black women. Here we will share, teach, and laugh, yes, I said laugh, as we guide you from just being excellent to stepping boldly into your zone of genius. I'm Joya Jefferson Nuri, your host and ICF certified leadership coach. Ready to level up together? Let's do this. Welcome back to our podcast. Meet Stephanie Reeves, a trailblazer in the world of public policy and mental health advocacy. As the Deputy Chief of Public Policy and Engagement at the American Psychological Association, Stephanie leads a team dedicated to driving big change, breaking barriers to mental health access, fighting discrimination, and working for health equity in both the federal government and local governments. Before this, she made waves as the executive director of the Maryland Psychological Association. So get ready to hear what Stephanie has to say about mental health in our country now. Welcome, Stephanie, to Unshackled Leadership.
Thank you so much, Joya. It's a pleasure to be on this podcast. I am a listener.
Oh, nice.
And I've enjoyed your episodes. And so I consider it an honor to be a guest.
Oh, that's wonderful. That's wonderful. And I say to everybody else who comes and sees us regularly, make sure you subscribe. That's the way we're going to know that you're there. So thank you, Stephanie, for that. Do you know, let's start with your background. I want to get into what you and your team are doing, especially the part of making criminals of people who are having mental health episodes. But I want to start with you. Why would you get into this level of advocacy around mental health?
Well, so let me start with my journey to even government relations.
Okay.
Because it's not often that you see a Black woman in this space. You would think it'd be more common, but unfortunately, it's not. I will say in my 20-year-plus career, it has gotten better. Mm-hmm. I'm a native Washingtonian.
Okay.
And so grew up all around, Northwest, Capitol Hill, all that. But yet knew very little about it. And I attended George Washington University. And during my sophomore year, the summer before my junior year, I had an internship with a woman who had her own nonprofit association, and it was to gear towards women who worked in federal government who mm-hmm. were unfortunately the victims of sexual harassment.
Gotcha.
And one of the things we got to do was go to the Hill, and we went on different Hill visits, but we also had a congressional briefing. And I was completely unfamiliar with what this was. And I said, so what is this as a career? And that's when I learned about government relations. And from there, it was really a steady career in different associations.
We'll go back a second. Let's go back a second.
Yeah.
I want to do that. You did the congressional briefing. What were your feelings sitting in the congressional office with either the congressperson themselves or a staffer, a senior staffer? What did that feel like for you?
As a college student, it was cool, and also just sort of, wow, this is what they talk about on the news all the time. And, you know, my parents were avid, you know, they watched the news. My mom still watches the 5 o'clock news every mm-hmm. single day to stay informed. She still takes the Washington Post. Mm-hmm. And so it was a really amazing experience because, you know, even though we're taught history in school and sometimes we're taught politics, I don't think we are actively taught about the role that we have as citizens in being able to go and talk to our legislators about the issues that are concerning to us. So it was an amazing experience.
Yes. So go back to your story. I just wanted to let people understand, because the first time you're sitting in a congressional office is you just want to I would want to pull out a flag and start waving it. Even though I was always on the opposition of most of what was going on, I was part of the human rights, human dignity voices, but it was still sort of like, dang, this is really exciting.
Yeah. And I would say, as somebody again who's done this for over 20 years, I still feel that way when I go and do my Hill visits. So going back to my story again, thinking about, you know, different healthcare, working for different healthcare associations. My first experience, in fact, you mentioned that I work with the American Psychological Association. I'm actually a Rebound employee, which I think should say a lot about sort of my dedication in this field and to particularly that organization. And I was a lobbyist in what's called their public interest office. And that is the office that deals with what we call social justice issues, and was there for 5 years, left to take an executive director role with the Maryland Psychological Association, and was there for nearly 7 years. And then there was an opportunity that came forth through their new advocacy office, and thought this would be a great opportunity to transition back into government relations. And that was almost 3 years ago next month. And so I, having worked almost probably at this point, almost 10 years in the mental health field and advocacy, it's a really eye-opening experience, because when I was first with APA, you could rarely get people talk about mental health. It was really all about physical health. And I mean, even when I did my Hill visits, it was sort of hands off. We don't want to talk about it. And it's so different now, where everybody wants to talk about it, because unfortunately we're in the midst of a mental health crisis.
Yeah.
It started in earnest during COVID, and unfortunately it's continued. And if there is an upside to all that's happened in the last 5 years or so, is that I think people have now recognized the need to take care of their mental health. The problem that I think we are seeing with that is that utilization is up, but access to services, it still remains a challenge. And even after, what we consider this, I consider it probably this old phase of COVID, and we're now in a new phase where it's now our reality. There are still issues with it. APA recently did a survey of their practitioners, and many practitioners are still experiencing wait lists. And so if you wanted to go and see a psychologist, in some instances, you're still waiting 1, 2, 3, sometimes 4, 5, 6 months.
Well, I have a friend. I have evidence of that. I have a friend who finally got into her insurance, she got an appointment and during COVID. And she thought this now meant she could have weekly visits. No, she saw that therapist in July, I think, 2020. And maybe I'm making up the months, but she didn't see him again for several months. The next appointment was in October. And it's like, what do I do between here and October if part of the problem was domestic violence? Mm. It's like she didn't want to call the police. She thought she just needed some counseling to get some tools. So that really is happening, that, happening in real life. You were saying about access. Mm-hmm. Now, that was one example of access. Mm-hmm. But suppose you're in crisis. Do you still have problems with access?
Well, there are situations. So in an emergency, and most, if not all, mental providers beyond psychologists will tell you this, if there is a critical emergency, you are asked to dial 911.
Yeah.
But, that is one of several different steps in that process. And I mean, I think if you were talking about a crisis, there are still challenges with services there as well, because I mean, how often do you call 911 and you may be waiting a few minutes for a police officer or some other type of authority to show up in those instances? So, we're facing a pretty significant challenge here when it comes to mental health throughout. I mean, again, there are ways to deal with the immediate crisis. But as you pointed out, you know, you see, you know, if you need to go see someone and you see, you have that first appointment and then it's, well, I can't wait. I don't want to wait 6 months to see my, you know, see them again. I want to go back and see them weekly. And that is still, I will say with the survey, it did indicate that the wait list is, it's still there, but it's not as bad of a problem as it was, say, in 2022 or 2023. Mm-hmm. But we're in 2025, and there are still psychologists with wait lists. And I think we're still going to see that because there's also the challenge of having more providers just in available already. You mentioned insurance, for example. A lot of psychologists do not accept insurance.
Right.
And it's not that they don't want to. It's just the reimbursement rates for insurance for mental health broadly is not the same as it would be if you were to experience, you know, if you broke your leg or if you had some other type of physical ailment. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that plus the paperwork does not make it feasible for mental health providers to provide those services and still make somewhat of a living. Yeah. And so a lot of the services are fee for service. Now, there are psychologists that offer sliding scales. Mm-hmm. They will work with the patient because they know services are available, but it is a challenge to try to find someone who accepts your insurance and have availability even in 2025.
Why is it that mental health professionals are not reimbursed like my primary care doctor?
I think there's a number of different reasons behind it. I think we are still dealing with a lot of it is still with the stigma of, you know, providing mental, you know, just being able to provide mental health versus physical health. I mean, that stigma is still there. And so I think that some of that's into play. And I think it's also if you are, you know, if let's say you go back, you know, going back to the break your leg example, you broke your leg, there's usually a dedicated course of treatment. You know, after like maybe a few weeks or, you know, a month or so, your leg's going to be in a cast. And then after a certain period of time, we feel that the leg is pretty much have set and it's strong enough. And then we can take the cast off and then there's physical therapy and such.
Yeah.
You really can't say the same for if I'm treating depression or anxiety. You can't say, oh, there's a 6-week course. I mean, there are programs available out there that are 6-8 week treatment. But if your anxiety is serious enough, 6 or 8 weeks are probably, it's probably may not be enough to, you know, to deal with your situation. You may be seeing, you know, a lot of my psychologist members when I was with Maryland Psychological, they had patients they had been seeing for 20 or 30 years.
I know those stories.
Yeah. And, you know, if you're an insurance company, you're like, well, we don't want to just pay in perpetuity.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, when is this going to end? And so I think that some of that is in play. But it's also, I think the big overarching issue is mental health is, while we are, again, talking about it a lot more, it's still not seen, I think, in the same vein as physical health.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's something that at APA we really tend to strive for because they really are connected. I mean, a lot of people who've experienced some physical health challenges, some of that can be tied back to stress.
Yeah.
And so there is that connection. And so there are efforts out there to really work towards getting people to understand that interconnection between physical and mental health. But, you know, we didn't get to uptick on mental health overnight. It's going to continue to take some more time and some more education because I think we still as a society don't have a great understanding of mental health. We only talk about it in extreme cases whenever there's something going on. And I think we need more education just broadly in our society about what mental health is, what mental health isn't, and how we treat it effectively.
What mental health is and what mental health isn't. That is a really good question. It is something for us to divide. So what is mental health?
So I want to preface for the audience that I am not a psychologist.
Right, right.
I have a bachelor's degree, and that's as far as I got.
Yeah.
So I would see it as really thinking about, you know, your mind and, you know, and what is, you know, what are some of the things that you're experiencing through your mind? And I think in terms of kind of what isn't, I think we think of mental health and again, the most extreme circumstances. And we don't think about it as how do I, you know, I'm stressed. you know, my job is out of control. My family's out of control. What am I doing? And I don't think we think of it in those terms. We think of it as, you know, the person that goes into some public forum and shoots up a school or something like that. We think of it in that instance. And actually, the research shows that those who with severe mental illness are more likely to be victims rather than the perpetrators of violence. But again, you know,
more likely to be the victims
versus
thinking victims in what way?
So if there was a circumstance where there was a crime committed or some heinous act, those with mental illness are more likely to be the victims versus those who are the perpetrators. So, because you know how, like, whenever we see a school shooting or some other mass shooting, the first thing that people say is, oh, that person must have a mental illness.
Yeah.
That's not always necessarily the case. And again, we have research that says that. Yeah. When I say what mental health is and what it isn't, I want us broadly to kind of think about, you know, how you are feeling in any moment. Because we all get stressed, and sometimes stress can be, you know, motivating for us to do what it is that we need to do. Sometimes there's good stress, and then sometimes there's stress where it's
debilitating.
It's very much so. Very mm-hmm. much so. We can't function. And then when it gets to the point where it's debilitating, then there, the question is this impacting my daily life? And if it is at that point, that's where the question comes, what do I do about it? Where can I go? What can I do? And I think we only think of it as, oh my goodness, I must have to have a nervous breakdown to see a psychologist. No, you don't. If you're experiencing stress, and again, it's impacting your daily life to the point where it's impacting just your ability to get out of bed or, you know, have regular functions that you do, that's when you may want to have a question of whether you want to see someone.
And it doesn't have to get that far. I know as a coach, I have clients who will come through and I can recognize you need help beyond coaching. Mm-hmm. There is an anxiety I can't get you to manage with meditation. There is a sadness that journaling with me, talking it out with me can't be lifted. And that's, you know, part of my training through the International Coaching Federation is to try to recognize when it's outside of my ballpark. Mm-hmm. And I have a psychiatrist and a psychologist, both Black women, who I refer people to. I don't just say, well, you need a shrink. I'm just going to let you go. I can't do that ethically. And I find that that is what happens where the women I work with, and you know, I work with all Black women, women of color, and they can't seem to understand that what's going on with them is not normal. Mm. Well, of course I'm going to be stressed. My job is a mess. My boss hates me. My children are teenagers. My husband's, you know, not the best. And this is how I'm supposed to feel. So not recognizing that's a mental health problem.
Right.
Because you're supposed to live life in peace.
Yes. And I think, Joya, you probably in your experience with those you coach and you refer out to, I think some of that is also cultural for us. Because I know when I was growing up, and I would imagine the same with you, when we knew we had relatives that had mental health challenges, mm-hmm. it was never talked about.
Well, no, but they were just the crazy cousin.
Right, exactly. That you locked up in the room somewhere in grandma's house.
Right, you just ignore that. Okay, they're in trouble again. All right, well, we don't want to embarrass the family. That is really important. Mm-hmm. Like, we're the fine, upstanding people on the street. Mm-hmm. And this person's behavior is clearly bipolar. Mm-hmm. But we didn't have that vocabulary.
Right. Right, right. And I think it's also indicative of, you know, not only what our you know, cultural upbringing, but also the fact that, you know, when I mentioned access and talk about lack of providers, you know, we definitely have a problem with the lack of providers, particularly in minority communities, particularly Black, Hispanic, in terms of providers. We have, you know, we have a lot of them. You've mentioned a couple of them, but we need so much more because, again, the upside is that we are now starting to recognize that, you know, that crazy uncle that we locked away probably could have benefited from a therapist. And we're not locking them up anymore. We're encouraging everyone to take care of their mental health and see someone when it needs, when we need to. But a lot of people want to see someone that looks like them because there's that relatability.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. When we talk about the communities of color, the stigma is there. They don't want to go. There is the money that we just talked about. You got to be able to pay out of your pocket to go to do that. But you're an advocate. What are the answers you're seeking?
Well, we're seeking it from a number of...
Fix it, Stephanie. Fix it.
I'm trying. Okay. I'm trying, Joya. But and when I talk about access, I also want to talk about the fact that in terms of entry into the profession, for example, you think about psychology, you know, the entry level for a psychologist is the doctoral level.
Yeah.
And so earning a PhD is not cheap. And I think we all know that.
Or quick.
Exactly. No, you're talking many more years of school because you're talking about your doctorate, your postdoc and all that.
Right, right.
But also there is the cost to be licensed. Mm-hmm. For example, you know, you have to, there's an application, you know, for Maryland, for example, there is a cost to apply, to be licensed in the state. There's a jurisprudence exam that you have to take. There's a cost for that, to take that exam. And so these, all these other things. And then once you're licensed, you have to renew your license.
Yeah.
And that's a cost as well. And so those are, there's so many other different aspects.
Then you
to
have
it.
To have an office. You have to have the Zoom. And then you have to have the facility. You have to have the marketing. You have to have the budgeting. You have to have your management of your money. It's like you're still running a business.
Yes.
While you're doing this.
Exactly. Exactly. Now, there is a interstate compact for psychologists called SciPac, and it allows psychologists to work in various states that are part of the compact. And those who are in the D.C. area, pretty much all the states around you, your immediate states around you, are part of SciPac. And so in some instances, you don't have to be licensed. Like, you can be licensed in Maryland, but see, if you're in SciPac, you can see, you know, patients in D.C., Delaware, Pennsylvania, and the like, Virginia. So that helps a little bit. But going back to your question about what are we doing about it, we have to attack it from a number of different fronts. Because again, even though I mentioned earlier that members of Congress, congressional staff, seem to be more open to the conversation of mental health, and they are. There is actually a bipartisan congressional caucus on mental health now that exists in the House. So that wasn't something that always existed. So that they recognize the importance. But as far as those of us who are advocating on the Hill, there's still a lot of education that we need to do about mental health in general. There's a lot of education about, I mean, most people don't know the difference between a psychologist and a psychiatrist, and there is a difference between the two. And really, it's also about funding. It's also about directing the funding where it needs to go, because you can ask for more funding, but you also have to direct it to where you need to have it. And so there are bills that we have supported in the past that looks at, for example, how do we increase the mental health workforce? And there's a bill that actually the APA has been supporting that will look at providing additional resources to HBCUs, for example, and Hispanic serving universities that will help them, you know, continue to push forward the mental health workforce through their universities. So that's one aspect to it. So there's legislation that's out there. A lot of it, again, is also education. It's also getting our members in front of legislators. And, you know, going back to the whole, when I go to the congressional offices, I still feel a certain way about it. And it's exciting. I love seeing our members go up. And it's funny because, you know, these are people who have been practicing 20, 30 years. They have a PhD. They've written all the books. They've had all the publications. They've done all the presentations. But to have them go and speak to a congressional staffer, it's like asking them to give up their firstborn child.
Yeah.
They're like, oh my goodness, you want me to do that? I said, yes, we do. And then it's the excitement of watching them tell their story about what it's like to be the only site, you know, if you're in a rural area, the only psychologist in a 90-mile radius.
Yeah.
I mean, that's obviously not sustainable. And telling them about, this is why we need more funding, because we need to bring more people into these jurisdictions because we don't have enough. And so it's really a, I'm a Marvel fan, as one of your previous guests is also as well. And I actually said this in a meeting yesterday. I said, this is going to be an Avengers level work that we have done, and particularly now that we're going to have to do. It's literally going to be all of us working together, psychologists, psychiatrists, social workers, counselors, psychiatric nurses, the full breadth of the mental health workforce is going to have to work on multiple efforts. And so if you are a Marvel fan and you remember that final third act battle in Endgame, that's what mental health is going to have to look like. Mm-hmm. It literally is going to be like that, where you have all these different battles happening throughout this one vast landscape, because those are where all the challenges are. I mean, you know, we're hearing about cutbacks to the federal agencies that have jurisdiction over mental health. You know, losing staff is not going to be helpful to us. Losing funding is definitely not going to be helpful to us. And so it's, we all have to fight together to work on it. And I do my little part, but I tell you, Joya, it's not me doing it alone. There's many other people that are working on that effort.
That's really great. I love that Endgame analogy, because like my previous guest, Artesia Moore, I'm a Marvel's like, da-da-da-da, I'm yes. All in it, okay? But you made a comment earlier about there being an only psychologist in a 90-mile radius. You know, that's like across three eastern states, mm-hmm. You know? And so, or two eastern states. What would we do? What would the society do if there was only one doctor, physical doctor, primary care doctor within a 90-mile radius? What would happen?
I would say if it was from a physical health standpoint, there would definitely be fighting. And honestly, I mean, Joya, I think we're already there. If you're talking about Medicaid and Medicare beneficiaries, they are kind of already there, because doctors are pulling out of that network left and right as well. And, you know, don't even get me started with like mental health. They're definitely, you know, there's definitely not a lot that are in the Medicaid system, even though there are other services. That would definitely cause a fight, you know, to increase access. But I think broadly with healthcare, that's some of the challenges that we're potentially facing. And again, I'm thinking about it from, you know, these rural healthcare, you know, these rural areas where, you know, more cows than people. But, you know, when you have one person in these areas and the rural hospital is going to be closing, where are you? And this doesn't stop the fact that there are going to be people who are going to need services. And they don't have always the transportation. They don't always have the infrastructure. And so telehealth, you know, one thing that really came out of the pandemic was telehealth and the rise, and particularly with mental health, which is helpful, but, you know, that, and we right now still have the availability of it in many instances, but that's only going so far. A lot of jurisdictions, a lot of states are looking at audio only as a way to provide services, because I think one thing we learned in the pandemic is that not everybody has a computer. Not everyone has access to internet. Some people have a landline phone in their house and that's it. And if that's the difference between saving a life and not, then we have to do what we can. So you're going to see, we have seen, and you're going to probably see more of how can we then fill in the gaps to provide services and care where there is one provider and they are miles away from you or really anybody you know that would need services. And so there are ways we can fill in the gaps, but, you know, we're really just filling in gaps. We really are not addressing sort of the broader issue of, you know, in that case, increased broadband access, mm-hmm. internet access that's affordable, computer access that's affordable. So those are just some of the ways that we can deal with it. But, you know, it's not ideal when there's already a lack of providers and more people are now retiring out of the field. And, you know, the challenge of getting more people into the field is where we are also fighting on that end as well. How do you get more people? How do you convince, you know, high school students now to go into psychology to earn a doctorate degree that may cost them $200,000, and their first job is going to be in a community health center paying $48,000.
Right, exactly. But you know what? There's also passion. Because everybody who stands there as a psychiatrist, psychologist, everybody who stands there is there for a reason, and they paid the same amount of money. Maybe not as much if you did it 40 years ago, but it's a passion. It's like, who wants to be a surgeon? You're like 90-100 years old before you finish that education. But millions of people around the world want to be, maybe hundreds of thousands around the world want to be surgeons. So I see the problem, but you really don't want somebody there who doesn't have the passion for it. Now, we can figure out how it doesn't cost $200,000. We should figure out how these services, maybe your undergraduate degree is free in this country. So then that's going to take a bunch of the cost off of you. And then your specialties, because you're going into service, you know, you vow, we'll pay for, we do teachers. You vow you're going to work in that community and we will pay a chunk of your tuition. Problem with that with teachers is they actually only, a lot of them actually only stay that 3 years. Mm-hmm. And then they go off and get a teaching job where they can make real money. Or they don't have to deal with the urban or the rural problems of, you know, more cows than people. And you're out here when you're a DC girl, all of a sudden you're in the middle of Oklahoma trying to figure out your life. Okay. But these things are fixable, do you think, Miss Advocate?
I think everything is fixable. Everything. Okay. It's just, I think some problems are going to take a little bit more effort than others. And you're right. There are many, and I mentioned, you know, the entry to psychology is a doctorate degree, but you know, for counselors, it's master's degree, which is yet another level of education, but it's still there. There are ways to make, you know, all of it affordable. Again, SciPac, I think, has been a huge help for many psychologists. You know, again, if you're based in a DC area, before, you would have to be licensed in D.C., Maryland, Virginia, sometimes Delaware, Pennsylvania, to see all those patients, whereas now you just need to be licensed in one state, and you can. And if you're in SciPac, in the system, you can see patients throughout that area. Mm-hmm. So that has helped. I think, you know, again, these issues did not appear overnight. It's been sort of longstanding where, you know, in extreme cases, a lot of mental health hospitals have been closed. And so then where do people end up? Unfortunately, they end up in jail.
Yeah.
So then you have that. And so yes, I would say these problems are fixable. Are they immediate fixes? No. A lot of these are long-term because, again, it did not happen overnight. The funding, you know, I think is going to be a big part of it. But also, as you mentioned passion. I'm glad you mentioned it because our members have passion. They definitely have passion. They would not be doing this otherwise.
Absolutely.
Because it's not easy work. It's definitely not. I've talked to, you know, regardless of whether I was at APA or Maryland Psychological, I've talked to a lot of our members, and you have to have a love to do this work because you want to help. You want to help people, and they help people on a number of different fronts, but it's also how can we be helpful to them? So we're always fighting for that reimbursement piece. I have colleagues who have been doing this work for years and continue to do it because, again, it's not an overnight fix. So we have to attack it on multiple fronts, whether it's education, whether it's the practice of psychology, whether it's just getting the public to understand better what mental health is and being more supportive of it. And, you know, asking their legislators, hey, we don't have a lot of psychologists in our area. We need them. Why can't we get more in our community? And those are going to be some of the ways that we address them.
Yeah. I have seen you talked about addressing mental health on multiple levels. How many times have we watched a camera, a dash cam, or the body cam of a policeman confronting a big black guy, okay? Or the woman that came into her house and shot her in her house. She clearly was not stable. This woman went to her stove and started working with a pot of boiling water. The officer is 20 feet away from her. Mm-hmm. She had not lifted it. Even if you listen to what she was saying, this woman is having an episode mm-hmm. of some sort. And that's not just me as a coach with some training here. That's me as a human, mm-hmm. like an adult. This officer then thinking she was going to throw the water on him. I can see how he's concerned, but all it would mean is back up a little bit. She was already 20 feet away from her. Okay. He shot her to death. Mm-hmm. He shot her to death. And we see this a lot. where the body cam tells you the officers, this is one guy. Sometimes there's two or three of them, and they don't know what to do. They never think to tase, if that's the problem. And there is this belief that Black people are more unstable than white people. Because white people get away with that more often than Black people do. Mm-hmm. When you talked about handling the mental health crisis on multiple levels, how do you address that?
In that instance, I think what we – so I, and I know from my work with Maryland Psychological Association that there are a number of different police departments in the state that will offer training on addressing someone or approaching someone that appears to be having a mental health crisis. Probably, you know, there seems to be likely the need for more training and more updated training. I know that there are also jurisdictions around the country that have enacted laws where whenever someone is having a mental health crisis, that the police are not the first person that are called.
Yeah.
There is actually those who are trained in addressing mental health, that will be sort of that first line.
Yes. Chicago has that.
Yes. So that is that.
In Chicago, they call this first line person and the police. But the mm-hmm. first line person starts the conversation.
Yes.
Starts the pull down, centering them down. The police yes. are there if it gets out of hand.
Exactly.
To protect the person having the crisis and the mental health professional if it comes to that.
Yes.
Police are not to interfere unless they're asked by the mental health professional.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So those.
I think
so
that's
those
a great
are been,
policy.
Yeah. So those are some aspects to how it's been addressed, and I know that you know again, there's been efforts to you know provide more training. I know some of our members when I was at Maryland, there were some of our members that actually were responsible for a lot of that training to various police departments and okay. such. But again, I think also broadly there again, I think it also speaks to just how mental health is not always understood
yeah.
broadly.
Yeah.
And so, because again, I think, again, we immediately see someone who's having a mental health crisis and immediately think violent. And that may not always be the case. There are some yeah. people who are, but that might not always be the case. And if you're not specifically trained to understand the nuances, then you're going to immediately think, oh, if they're acting out of sort for what society says is normal, therefore that person, and I think sometimes our mind immediately goes to violent, and violent against yeah. me instead of maybe, you know, themselves or somebody else, then it's, okay, we got to deal with it and probably we got to meet violence with violence. And
yeah, and if the officer walks in and all the officer is managing is
right.
his or her own fear, there's absolutely no way to
right.
get to the bottom of this. If all you're processing is, I might get hurt, I might get hurt, I might get hurt, you can't process even
right.
your training as a police person. You're, you know, I know from my clients that a lot of mental health things are managed with a small dosage of a medication. That could be something that helps them sleep. Maybe they get enough sleep. They can manage the stress of the next day. Or mood stabilizers. There's millions of them out there. And you and your psychiatrist, if you get one, or your primary care doctor can give you a prescription. But so often, when I say this to clients, they say, oh, I don't want to be on a pharmaceutical. I don't do drugs. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but do you do crazy? You know, I don't
right,
I never
right.
would say that to anybody, you know, but I never would say that. But do you do stress? Do you do anxiety? Do you do laying in bed? Do you do not managing your day-to-day operations at work? You do that. So a lot of these things are small dosages. I don't know. I don't even know what a small dosage would be, but I know the clients who use them have mm-hmm. more stable mm-hmm. are more stable. What do you say to people who say to you,
well,
I don't
so
do pharmaceuticals?
Psychologists, so the basic difference between psychologists and psychiatrists is that psychiatrists are the ones that will prescribe medication.
Yeah.
Psychologists, their first line is talk therapy.
Right.
And so I probably can't speak to what would be said. I can tell you from, you know, talking to other psychologists that they tend to work together with many psychiatrists. More
and
often
that's
than
what's
not.
What's going on? They go to the psychologist, which is affordable. And then they work together. The psychologist thinks they need a medication.
Exactly. Right. Exactly. Where it's but in that it's also in addition to talk therapy.
So they
work hand in hand.
Right.
With it. And so I'm assuming if you go and you speak to a psychologist, you're like, you know, maybe you could benefit. And they're like, well, no, I really don't. You know, that's something where probably it's like, okay, we can continue
to
kind of this
therapy.
Course, but if we feel that it's otherwise, we need to do something.
But I think the pharmaceuticals have a stigma.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah, I would say so.
You're taking a psychiatric drug when you would absolutely take insulin if you were diabetic.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
But Joey, I think it goes back to what we've talked about throughout this conversation in that, you know, there's more that we need to do to talk about mental health and just, you know, being open with it. And, you know, stigma exists to just not just seeing, you know, a mental health professional, but also if I'm saying, oh, I'm on, you know, this medication for, you know, my anxiety, then it's like, oh, you need to take drugs to control anxiety? That sounds odd.
Well, and that's so arrogant from the person who would pose that question.
Right. 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 But that way, right. Because again, if you had high blood pressure, you said, I take high blood pressure medication. They'd be like, oh, that's great.
Which one do you take? Yeah.
Right. You're taking care of your health. And so I think, again, there's a lot that we need to do. And I say we, in terms of those of us in the mental health space, to educate people in terms of your mental health is worth saving and it's worth taking care of. And if that's a combination of talk therapy and psychotropic drugs, that will, you know, that's going to help you, then let's get you there. But we need to be more open and talking about that they have benefits just as you were to take, you know, medication for diabetes or high blood pressure or cholesterol.
That's a perfect way to end this conversation. That was brilliant. Stephanie Reeves, thank you so very much for being with us. You were a great guest. I'm so glad. I hope we can call upon you again throughout the year to come back and talk.
Absolutely. I enjoyed this conversation, Joya, and I hope that your listeners got a little kernel of it. And if you are, and if you don't mind, if you are struggling and you do want to see a psychologist, APA does have information on their website, and we'll make sure to provide it to you. You can go to www.apa.org.
And I'm going to put all of that in the show notes.
Fantastic.
So when you're listening to this right below the show, you'll have a way to email Stephanie. You'll have a way to go to APA's website. So Stephanie Reeves, thank you so very much for joining us here on Unshackled Leadership, A Lantern for Black Women.
Thank you, Joya.
All righty then. All right, to everybody else, we'll see you next episode. Peace and blessings. We've just completed another episode of Unshackled Leadership, A Lantern for Black Women. Our goal? To leave you feeling empowered and ready to take your next step with confidence and grace. A huge thanks to our audio engineer, Grammy Award-winning artist and producer, Carolyn Malachi, and to Darren Neplett, who composed our theme music. Your talent makes all of this possible. We're in our third season, so not to miss an episode, make sure you subscribe. Your support helps us grow. I'm your host, Joya Jefferson Nuri. I hope to have you back.